Laura Brody, for those meeting you for the first time, can you share a little bit about what you do and what's led to where you are today with your work?
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me. I guess I could start by telling a little bit of a story. I think I was probably about 16 or 17 and sat around the kitchen table with my mom in New York, and talking about what I was going to do with the rest of my life. Really common conversation when you're about that age, you're getting ready for university. And I really didn't know what to do. And my mom said to me quite convincingly, she said, "You should become a teacher." And I looked at her and kind of like, "Are you crazy?" Because I was barely surviving high school. I was not a very good student in high school at all. And not because I wasn't like academically, I couldn't do it, because I was a good student. Like in primary school, I was a very good student. But I got to high school, and the bullying and the exclusion and all the things got to be a little bit too overwhelming, and I just wasn't functioning well at school. School kind of became a place of like endurance and not really of learning. So for her to say that to me, and I said, "How could I ever become a teacher?" And P.S., university and master's degree later, and all of that, I went into teaching. And first I was teaching English as a second language, and then I transitioned into primary school. And then when I became a parent is when I discovered mindfulness, and it was actually something that I was looking for my daughter, because she's 12 now, so she must have been about 3 or 4, and she was really struggling. And so we went to therapy for her, and they helped us put out the flames, but I really wanted to know like where the fire was coming from. I wanted to know the behavior, like what was causing the quote unquote bad behavior. It wasn't bad behavior because you're three. Whenever you're behaving in a, I don't know, less than desirable way, there's usually a reason behind it. So
Yes.
I started, looking into things and doing research, as any good mother and good teacher would do. And I stumbled upon mindfulness. I don't know if it found me. I found it, and I started doing things with her. And then I really quickly realized that I was the one, or not the one, she needed it as well, but I really needed it just as much, if not more, than she did. So that was kind of the opening door. And then I started bringing it into the classroom little by little, because it was having such an amazing impact on me and like my emotional regulation, how I viewed myself, how I handled myself with the rest of the world, and all the things that happen, because mindfulness doesn't stop things happening. These things are going to happen, but it just really helps you navigate how you handle those things. And I thought, how can I not bring this into the classroom? So I brought it into the classroom little by little, lots of gratitude, which I know you love, and emotional regulation practices, all kinds of things. And it just was a game changer. It really was. It changed how classroom management happened, changed lots of different things, which I'm sure we can maybe go into a little bit later. And then it brought me to where I am today with Adventures in Albinism and the Teacher's Compass, because I just saw how the effects that it has on everyone involved. And I thought, I really need to bring this to the albinism community. And that's kind of where we are today. It's kind of how these projects were born and how it all started.
That's an interesting story. I love people's stories, and thanks for sharing that. And particularly how people get to where they are today, like in terms, especially teachers. Some teachers have that goal of being a teacher all their life, but others sort of stumble into it in some kind of way or get led in that direction. I was exactly the same. Like, I didn't think of being a teacher, but in the end, I did. I did go down that path as well. And you mentioned something, a couple of great things there, and one that really stood out was about the bullying back when you were at school. So, why? I mean, I guess with that bullying situation, how did that impact you? And I guess how did that impact you at the time, I reckon, and how maybe it shaped you today?
Well, I think for me, there's kind of two different types of bullying that maybe they kind of go under the same umbrella, but there's outright verbal abuse and then there's exclusion. And I had both. I really think I definitely had both. I had the teasing and the name calling and the questioning. And then the exclusion of kind of like wandering around the playground by yourself a lot and just not kind of, being invited into play in the earlier days and then later on just, as teenagers, just outright excluded. And I think in the beginning, well, it is very sad, even like 40 years later, I talk about it, I'm like, ooh, I get a bit emotional because it stays with you. It really,
Totally.
really does. And that's why I think it's so important to try and eradicate it as best we can. So I think it made me two things. I think it made me very kind of a hard person, which I'm not anymore, thanks to all the practices that I do and things that I engage in now. I'm much, much calmer and much softer person. But I think when you're constantly up against such abrasive language and being excluded, I mean, we're as human beings, we're pack animals. We want to be in the pack, and the punishment is exclusion. Back in the day when you were excluded, that meant death. When you weren't allowed in the pack, you were excluded, and that was it. You were out left to die. And so, of course, that's not what happened to me then. But those were the feelings, I think, that I felt, like, why? Why can't I play? Why can't I be involved? Why? And then, yeah, I think it just made me a bit of a kind of bit of a hard person. And then also, like, on the positive side of it, like a lot of wanderlust and a lot of like, okay, well, if here isn't great, what's out there? What can I go and see and do and experience? And then once I went to university, I mean, that was the beginning of the beginning for me. I started traveling and moving around, and life just changed a lot. Not to say that there aren't circumstances. I mean, in the workplace, I've experienced exclusion and bullying and discrimination. So it's not like it ended in school, but I think as you get older, you just learn how to deal with things differently.
Interesting, yeah. No, I can totally understand that. I mean, I was pretty lucky. Well, I felt fortunate. I didn't really feel excluded or bullied too much, like particularly through my childhood and teenage years. But there's one time that stood out, and I just remember it. You mentioned about how it sort of you got emotional then. Like when I go into schools and talk to students about like inclusion and empathy and these type of topics as well, I always talk about one story that a kid at a sports training just used to mock me all the time because I was. I guess I developed quite quickly and had a very deep voice at a young age. And he just wouldn't let up
Oh, he
about
was just jealous. Of course.
it. I'm not sure about that, but he just, every training session, it was, and it might not have been a like looking back, it's probably not a major thing, but at the time, like it really did impact me. I didn't want to go. And I still remember the kid's name and what he looks like. And like, it does stay with you. It's really interesting. And based off, I guess, your experience, how do you, go about making sure that young people, particularly in schools, and the students that you work with, young people that you work with now, how do you make sure that they understand the importance of inclusion? And I guess, or not bullying people, how do you go about that?
I think that's a really good question. I think, going back to what you said before, how did it affect you? I am hyper aware of when I'm in a social situation, whether it's at work or just in my personal life, I'm hyper aware of what's going on in terms of group dynamics. And if I see that someone is separated from the group, I will always go over and talk to them and, find a way to include them and bring them in. And I'm a very chatty person, as you can probably tell. And so I find it very easy to open conversation with people and to talk to people. And so I will often just make sure I bring them in. So in school, so important. I started a Kind Kids Club at school a while back, probably like 10 years ago. Really great initiative, first in the classroom and then like on in a whole school setting. And the Kind Kids Club was a way of making children sort of aware of kindness. So instead of When you come, the children come back from the playground or the patio. I don't know what you call it in Australia, but when they come back from the playground or from the patio, it's always, it's a lot of he did this and she did that and I couldn't play, da da da. And so for the Kind Kids Club, it was a complete flipped it around completely. And children would come in from the patio and we'd sit and we'd have some circle time. And children would talk about, Johnny let me play. I saw this person not talking to anyone, so I went over to talk to them. Somebody dropped their frisbee and I helped them. And so I think a lot of it is about making it explicit, like really bringing it out into light and saying, this is what exclusion looks like, this is what it feels like, and this is what we can do to make sure that nobody feels excluded. Nobody. Nobody wants to be excluded at all. And one
Awesome.
day it could be someone with glasses. One day it could be someone with albinism. Another day it could be a child in a wheelchair. It could be anybody at any day. And no child wants to feel, no adult wants to feel excluded, really.
Oh, couldn't agree more. And I think it's really, actually, it's really interesting you say that because I do this very similar activity to what you're talking about. Like, I get this like a circle, like a boundary, or like a zone type thing, and put included belonging and happy, and then ask the students, is it fair to say that everyone wants to come to or see you primary school, whatever it's called, and you want to feel included and you want to feel happy, and everyone says yes, absolutely, and then I'll put this arrow into that zone and have empathy because everyone can see that everyone wants to be included, they want to feel happy. So the question is, what can I do to make sure others feel that way? And I think that's really get. I think what you're saying there is spot on because I think it's really important to, I guess, model what inclusion looks like, but just to share that everyone wants to feel included. It's such an important thing for everyone to understand. And I mean, it's easy to say, but if young people and adults alike like understand that bullying shouldn't exist because like nobody likes to be bullied, so I'm not going to do that to anyone else. I mean, it's very easy to say, but in theoretically, if we can teach particularly young people those skills, hopefully they'll be able to grow up with that understanding that everyone does want to be included. Like nobody likes that feeling of being left out or bullied, and just asking like, what role can I play to make sure others feel included? And I think that's, yeah, I love that what you're saying there. And Laura, also just you mentioned a couple of times about albinism. Can you just explain a little bit more for those people who might not know what that is? And you are a person who has albinism and also lower vision. Would you, is that going back to when you were saying, is that the reason why you were bullied back in school as well?
I mean, I would say so. I think that is the main reason. As I said, I think lots of kids bully lots of kids for lots of different reasons. But for me, in my case, I can only speak from my experience, and my experience as a person with albinism and low vision. So albinism is basically a genetic condition. It's a recessive gene. It has to be present in both parents, and they pass it down to their child, and not necessarily both children. I have a sister who doesn't have albinism. And basically, it affects the production of melanin in your body, so you don't have any coloring. There are also different gradings of coloring. Some people have a little bit more, some people have less, some people have red hair. And so there are like about nine different types of albinism, but the most
Interesting. Yeah.
common type is the one that I have. I just found out the other day actually what type I have, because testing for different types of albinism was not a thing when I was growing up. And so like last week, I found I have a OCA one, which is the most common type. And so it affects the coloring of your hair, skin, and eyes. And then most people, I don't know anybody with albinism that doesn't have low vision. And because of many different factors, your eyes are affected and you have low vision as well. So we have to be careful with the sun. Many people wear glasses or contacts. I'm legally blind. So I use a magnifying glass to read. I can't drive, sunglasses. So yeah, there are a lot of things that affect you on a kind of daily basis.
Yeah, absolutely. And how did that going in from, and thanks for sharing that. That was really interesting to hear that. And how did that impact your like teach when you started teaching? Like, did you go into like a mainstream school? and teach it?
So,
How did that impact your teaching?
and how, yeah, it's a good question because there were some things that came up in the beginning. So I first started teaching English as a second language. So it's a different kettle of fish. It's like mostly like after school programs with smaller, well, first I started with adults anyway, so that's totally different. And then when I went into teaching kids, I remember doing my teaching practice. And I had a really great mentor. Mentors are so important. And during my teaching practice, I had a mentor, and I think it's like one of the first classes I was doing on my own. And I had the children sat down in the carpet in front of me, and I was looking out into this like sea of faces, and I thought, how am I going to learn where they are and everything else? And because I'd never been in that situation before, because teaching English as a second language, I used to stand up and move around a lot and get close to my students and be able to see them that way. But this way, doing carpet time, I was like, this is a bit challenging. So I went, and during one of my review sessions with my mentor, I said, what can I do? And she had this brilliant idea, which I have used ever since, always at the beginning whenever I'm in a new classroom situation, drawing a map of the children. So just basically, like, say there are 25 children, you've got five in a row, X amount of rows, and just putting their names and then having them sit in the same place all the time. In the beginning, anyway. Once I'm more familiar with what someone looks like, I can see them from farther away. It's a strange thing to explain to people. Like, once you know what someone looks like and how they move and their hair style, I think you can see them from further away. Just don't really know how that works, to be honest with you, but I know other people with albinism and low vision say the same thing. And so yeah, so just putting them in a map and then knowing where they are from there. And then other than that, I mean, there are also different degrees of being legally blind. So sometimes when you say to someone, "I'm legally blind," they assume that you really can't see anything and that you're blind. And there's a range of being legally blind. So if you're a person that's not legally blind, there's a range of what you can see as well, whether you have 20/20 or 20/40. And then between being legally blind and totally blind, there's also a range. And I'm on the cusp of not being legally blind and being legally blind. And then within blindness, there's also, every person is different. Even within blindness, there are some people who see a little bit of light, some people see a bit of shadow, some people have very, like, there's a very small percentage of people that are completely 100% blind, much smaller than I think people realize.
Right, interesting. With your in terms of percentages, is there a ratio? I'm not sure how to exactly ask the question, but do you have like 5% vision, or is it not really rated that way in terms of percentage?
I think here, I think in the States, it's like 2,400, I think it is. And then here it's like 0.5. It should be something like that. Different measurements in Europe and in the
And
States.
you mentioned where you are now. So you have Trevor Randall up. So you were from New York, but now you're in Spain. That's correct. And what do you in Spain, do you actually work at a school? You're running your own programs. What are you up to in Spain now?
Right. Well, I was working in the private school system here, and most like British and international IB schools. So I was there for about 15 years, and then this year I've stepped out of kind of official classroom teaching. I'm still te It's so funny. You can take the teacher out of the classroom, but you can't take the classroom out of the teacher. I'm still learning and teaching. That's what, like, a love of learning is like my top character strength in positive psychology and in the VIA framework. And so I'm constantly learning and teaching. And so now I'm just doing it in a different way. I'm doing it through Adventures in Albinism and through the Teacher's Compass. So I'm kind of taking a different role on as a teacher and trying to support teachers that are teaching children with albinism and support families as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I'd love to hear a bit more about that. So what are the differences between the two projects? Are they related or are they totally separate?
I would say there's overlap, but one is so it started with adventures in albinism. That idea came to me. My daughter has a crochet class, and near her crochet class, there's a big park. And so I drop her off at the crochet class, and there's a big fountain there, a waterfall rather, with a fountain at the bottom. And I often sit in front of there and I meditate while I'm waiting for her. And I was sitting there one day and I was meditating. And as ideas often do, it just kind of like, boom, it just was so clear. So clear, because when you're in like deep meditation, you're just kind of, I don't know, if everybody's mind is different, but when I'm really deep into it, like my mind just sort of like solves all these problems and things that I'm thinking, not problems, but situations and things that I'm thinking about. Because you're just giving it space to sort of rest a little from all of the thinking and the processing and the remembering and the planning and all the things. And I just thought, I've got to bring this to the albinism community. And that was it. And that was it. Like, that was like a boom moment. And now I can't not do it. It's one of those things that, like, once you sometimes, once you see something, you can't unsee it type of thing. Well, this is the same sort of thing. So I just thought, this is it. This is what I have to be doing. And that's kind of how Adventures in Albinism started. It's a free Facebook group. Anybody can join. Anybody who is a supporter of the albinism community. There are a lot of parents in there, and parents of young children, and then PWAs, which is people with albinism as well. And so each month, I have a theme. So one month it might be gratitude, might be self-compassion. It might, I don't know, all different kinds of themes. This month we're doing love, and not the hearts and flowery kind of love. It's more like self-love and self-compassion. And then within those monthly themes, I'm working with a framework called the Mind Compass. So the Mind Compass is each week, we have a letter. And so the M is for mindfulness, the I is for identity, the N is for navigation, and then the D is for dialogue. And so throughout the month, we're exploring different things. I've also got some of the character strengths in there from the VI framework. And so there's a lot of stuff, a lot of exploring happening. I do like a little mini podcast, and I relate everything to, it's not really a mini podcast, it's like me talking about a subject related to the topics, and then related to either mindfulness, identity, navigation, or dialogue.
Brilliant. That's
So
such
that's
great support.
quite a mouthful, all of that. And then yeah, so we do, like, I have activities on there. I do Storybook Sunday, so I take a story and I read. I think it's important for children with albinism to see people with albinism just doing everyday things like reading a book and reading with the magnifying glass. So I take a book, I have the camera on, I'm reading with the magnifying glass, I'm looking close at things. So I think it's important for them to see someone like them, because that's a really big issue for the self-worth of people with albinism, is we don't see other people like us very often in books. That's another thing I'm working on as well. I'm collaborating
Oh,
with
good.
someone on working on a book, storybook for children, and we just need to be seen. And so I think Adventures in Albinism is a great space for people to come and kind of get a feel for what mindfulness is, how positive psychology can help them help their children, because obviously small children are not on the group, but it's mostly for parents to get some information, and then hopefully pass that on to their kids. And then
Absolutely.
the Teacher's Compass is a more recent initiative that is like a membership group for teachers that are working with children with albinism. And because we are so spread out, it's very, very rare that a teacher has like more than one child with albinism. What I'm doing is providing like one house, one roof, so that teachers can be in the same place and have community where they can learn from each other. And then, yeah, I'll be doing training. There's also a wellness corner for teachers' well-being, because I think that often gets sorely, as you know, overlooked. And so there's like an 8-week mindfulness and positive psychology course that teachers can do in there. And so that's just getting going. So it's early days, and I am really, really excited about its potential.
Absolutely. And oh, I love those two well, I guess you call them projects if you like, or initiatives that you're working on. Such important, because you talk about, like, I guess inclusion, and there's so and something like albinism is something that I guess from a person who isn't involved in that community necessarily, sometimes we don't we forget about that. It is like an important thing to make sure that we do include, like, whether that's people with disabilities, whether that's in a wheelchair, but also like with something like albinism as well, like something that maybe people don't generally think about. And I don't mean that in a mean kind of way.
No, it's just it's not so common.
That's a good way to put it. And what are some of the challenges? So you mentioned, like, you've got the teacher's compass for the teachers, and then the adventures in albinism with more so, I mean, for teachers as well, but more so for the parents. What are some of those challenges that teachers and parents are finding when they're working or have young children with albinism?
So I think for teachers, it's like you said before, like people don't, it's not on people's minds because it's not a very common thing. It's just, it's one in every 17 to 20,000 people, and for approximately, and it depends on where you are in the world. In sub-Saharan Africa, there's a higher rate, and in other parts of the world, it's less. So your numbers are a bit, it's approximately 400,000. So me personally, I've never had a child with albinism in my class, and I've been in education for 25 years. So you could go through your entire career and not ever see someone with albinism. So I think really the challenge for teachers and parents, or for the children, I'm sorry, which was.
Fatigue, I'm not more so, I'll probably both, like, really, but for the maybe what parents are finding at home that maybe their children are feeling a certain way, or teachers as well, so include. But I think those there, that's probably the what I'm asking, yeah.
Teachers and parents. So I think what I see and what I've observed is, everyone wants three things: safety, satisfaction, and connection. Those three things are essential to flourishing and thriving, no matter how old you are. And of course, safety comes first. If we don't feel safe, then satisfaction and connection don't even come into play. So I think what parents and teachers see is that children with albinism at schools, they don't feel safe to engage. They don't feel safe to be themselves, and they don't feel safe even literally sometimes because they're being bullied and physically accosted or verbally abused. And so their sense of safety and their sense of I can be who I am is not there. And so when that's not there, as I'm sure you well know, if I don't feel safe, there's no way I'm going to learn. And so I think that is the biggest issue that I think parents and teachers see, is because of the bullying and the exclusion, that the children don't feel safe, and then they don't feel satisfied in what they're learning because school becomes a place of like constant battle, and I don't want to go because this is happening and that's happening. And then, of course, the last part is the connection, which we've been talking about. It's like, I want to feel connected. If I don't feel connected, then I feel isolated and I feel alone and I feel lonely. And so then you're going down all of those things. And so for teachers, they don't, there's a lot of lack of, it's just lack of information. Lack of information on what the experience of a child with albinism is really like, what's happening for them, their reactions. Like sometimes if I've been in a meeting at school, for example, I will close my eyes, not because I'm sleeping, because teachers' meetings are boring. Not that,
No,
no. Not that at all. But sometimes I just need to close my eyes because there's so much visual stimulation throughout my
absolutely.
day that my eyes are tired all the time. And so teachers might look at a child who's closing their eyes, or they might be turning away because one eye is stronger than the other one, and they look like they're not looking at you, but they are. And so It's those things I think are really complicated for teachers because they're just not sure of what's happening. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think, I mean, you're providing a great group as well, but I think from a teaching point of view, it'll be, I mean, you can add more to this as well, Laura, but I'm assuming that would be, as a teacher, be a really good idea. Just have a conversation with the parent or even the child, just to get to know them a little bit more. And some of those, as you say, like whether that's a closing their eyes, some of those, I guess, things they might do that may appear not to be engaged, but they are. So is that a good tip for teachers? Would you suggest?
I think parent-teacher communication is fundamental. Fundamental for any child, but especially with children that have additional needs or different challenges that are happening for them. Yes, I think really sitting down and talking with a parent and having the parent feel comfortable to say, like, this is what's happening for my child. This is what works for them. This is what doesn't work for them. So, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, brilliant. And I guess to build on that connection and or belonging as well, and obviously that's a big part of what we've spoken about today and what you're doing. So what does that real belonging look like for people with albinism or low vision in your opinion?
So I think there are a couple of things that are really important to talk about in terms of belonging. So belonging, there's the physical side of it, of I have low vision and things might not be accessible to me the way they are to other children. So whether that's board work, story time, just lining up and knowing where to line up properly. When there's the sun in your face, you can't see anything and you can't see the person. If there's light behind someone, it's very hard to see them. So usually you want to seat a child who has albinism with light behind them. And so these are kind of like these little tricks that as a teacher you might not know, and that a child might not feel like they have the same access to everything that's going on in the classroom, and that affects how their sense of belonging in the room, because there are things happening around them, going on around them, children answering questions, children asking questions, maybe getting into groups to do smaller group work, and I'm over here and I don't know what's going on because I can't see, or I didn't read the instructions on the board. So those sort of mechanical things are really important to be aware of and know like what works for each individual child. And then of course there's the emotional side, which I think is something within the albinism community. There's a lot of talk about and monumentally important talk about skin protection, wearing sunscreen, eye protection, like all of those things are monumentally important because, again, going back to the safety, if you're not protecting yourself physically, you're not safe. And then there's all kinds of skin cancer and everything else. But the second side of that is the well-being side. And that's part of the conversation that I think is not happening as much as I would like to see it. So belonging in the well-being side and the emotional side is from, for example, like from an adult's perspective, if you're out in the playground and you're on playground duty and you're watching the children play and you see someone who's sort of maybe in the shade because they can't be in the sun, perhaps inviting children to come over and play over here because that person really can't be in the sun, they don't want to wear their hat, you know, there's all kinds of things that can be going on. So not having to ask to join is a big part of belonging, I think, being invited. Hey, come on and let's play, you know, come and be a part of this group. That is huge. And so, yeah, I think a lot of times that can be initiated by the adults that are around and they can model that kind of inclusive behavior.
That's so
So
true.
both sides, the technical side and then the emotional side of just being invited in, simple as that.
I love how you mentioned the modeling. I think it's so important that, particularly for young people who might not quite like, you know, a 5 or 6 year or 7 year old who probably doesn't quite understand, but having a teacher model, I think that's such an important thing and something that's so underrated in teaching that modeling. But also like having those, I mean, this is probably a slightly different topic, but modeling, but also having those conversations with students. So seeing that you're a real person as well, like sharing stories from your own world, that's a really good way to build that belonging and that connection with students also.
I definitely agree with that. And I used to put pictures up on a Monday morning, like pictures of my weekend, a little bit of things that I've done
Perfect.
for the weekend, and
Yeah.
and just say, oh, here, and then we went here, and then we went there. And I feel like they know you, because if
Yeah.
not, you could be anybody, really. And they spend 8 hours of their day, 40 hours a week with you.
Yeah. It's like when you used to when I was a teacher, I remember, and I think a lot of teachers talk about this, is like when you're the shopping center, and then a student that you teach walk past you and they stare at you as if you're not human because you shouldn't be anywhere else but school.
But school, yeah, they don't realize that you actually have a
Yeah.
life outside of
Yeah.
school.
No, this has been fantastic, Laura. I really appreciate like the insights that you're sharing and the tips. Where can people find out a bit more about some of the initiatives that you mentioned with the Teachers Compass and also the Adventures in Albinism?
So I have my website with the same title, Adventures in
Yep.
Albinism. I definitely invite people to go and check out the website, because there are some free resources that people can download. Parents can share with their children's teacher, or teachers can go there and download some things. I've also got some surveys on there as well, anonymous surveys. If you don't want to put your name, you don't have to. And these are surveys that help me get a better feeling for what teachers need, what people with albinism need, and what parents need. So do go in and check that out and become part of the conversation, please.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then on Facebook, just look up Adventures in Albinism, and there it is, free to get in. Please do answer the membership questions. There are so many people that don't answer the membership questions, and I have them there as a safety measure for the group, because it's because of the nature of the group, and there's, conversations, and there's children, things about children around. I do ask some safety questions. So if anyone does go to the group, please,
Yep.
please, please answer the questions. And then the Teacher's Compass, yeah, you can find that on my website. More information about where to find out how to become a part of that
Absolutely,
membership.
sounds great. Yeah, and we'll put those links in the show notes as well, so people can just click on them and go direct to them. And Laura, really appreciate your time, as I mentioned, and I love the insights. And yeah, I really admire what you're doing. Like, I love how people like travel as well, like New York to like international schools in Spain. Obviously, you've got around a lot, and also obviously had a huge impact on young people, not on the albinism community, but in schools around the world as well. So great job, and really enjoyed hearing a bit more about your work today. And hopefully our listeners have learned some things like I have and can take some things away.
I hope so as well. And thank you so much for having me. I really, really have enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
Pleasure.